And now on WRS, Michael McKay with the McKay Interview.
Hello, everyone. Many hold the view that climate change is the greatest issue of modern times. Now, personally, I'm not so sure. But whereas we complain about the weather, and it's a glorious day this morning in Geneva, and the Swiss and the British at least love to talk about the weather, climate is of another dimension, a much bigger dimension. I think it's a Scandinavian expression, there's no such thing as bad weather, only bad clothes. But that's a practical and a philosophical view. But I don't mean to take the subject lightly, and at the same time I'd not pretend to understand all the issues, except to say that having lived a long time and in three quite different countries, in the UK, in Jamaica, and in Switzerland, different climatically speaking, that is, I've seen and still can see the climate is changing, and that is even before I turn on the TV news to watch the latest disaster climate story. But what in heaven's name can we realistically do about it that will make any difference? And at what cost? And to whom? Over what period of time? And what if the corrective strategy being recommended by experts is wrong? To answer some of my many simple, yet I hope not simplistic, questions, I've invited today a man whose job it is to know these things. My guest is Professor Petteri Tallas. He's the Secretary General of the World Meteorological Organization. And if you live in Geneva or the region, you'll know it as that elegant, long, dark blue, high-rise building seemingly covered in louvres, Venetian blinds, beside the Jardin Botanique. He's from Finland and certainly knows about long winters, darkness and light for long periods. But more importantly, he travels the world. In fact, he's just come back from a long trip, he told me, as the head of this important international organization, and is best placed to provide an excellent professional and scientific overview, stripped of emotion and hype. I met him on one occasion before today, and that was my honest impression of him. Hello, Professor Tallas. Thanks for inviting me to your office today, and thank you for making time to talk to me and listeners to the McKay Interview.
So many thanks for the invitation, and it's my pleasure to be interviewed
it's
by
great,
you.
Great to see you again. Great to be here in your home, so to speak.
Welcome.
Tell me, Professor Tallas, a very simple question at the beginning, but at least to set the scene. What is WMO, World Meteorological Organization, if I can say it properly? What's it for, and what and who does it comprise? Who's in it?
Yeah, so we are the United Nations Specialized Agency on Weather, Climate, and Water. We are dealing with the global weather observing systems. We are dealing also with the global greenhouse gas monitoring systems. We are the host agency of IPCC, which provides these big scientific
reports. And IPCC, report. Just tell us the abbreviation stands for?
It's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
Right.
And that organization provides scientific reports on the status of climate and future evolution of climate. And we are also publishing annual status of climate reports, how things are proceeding in the real atmosphere and what's happening to the greenhouse gases which are causing this climate change. And thirdly, we are dealing with global water resources. And many of the impacts of climate change, that they are felt through water. And water is actually very important component in the climate system. We are dealing with melting of glaciers. We are talking about changes in precipitation patterns, drought, flooding, and also evaporation, which is a critical thing for the global food production capacity. And we have 193 members, practically all of the UN members.
So that reflects the UN membership.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. They are our members, and this year we are celebrating the 150th anniversary of WMO. We were established as International Meteorological Organization already 150 years ago, and the motivation was to standardize the global weather observing systems and freely exchange data. And if you want to forecast weather, one has to have at least regional data available, but in our case we are dealing with global data. And we are very much working as a vehicle to exchange data globally, which is very much needed for the weather forecasting. Without us, one wouldn't be able to provide high quality weather forecasts. So we are needed worldwide, and besides exchanging freely data, we are also exchanging know-how. And we have very fancy countries like UK, USA, most West European countries, which have modern weather services, but then we have half of our members which don't have such services in place. And that means that once a high-impact weather event hits those countries, the damage is much higher, both human losses and economic losses we can avoid by having state-of-the-art weather services in place.
So you're very much a clearinghouse. You're also a think tank. In fact, it seems from the way you've described it, and I had no idea that you were so old as an organization. I'm sure many people listening to this program wouldn't have imagined that you could be 150 years old. Always in Geneva, by the way, or was it in other capitals?
So we started in the Netherlands.
In the Netherlands.
And after the Second World War, we were moved first to Lausanne and thereafter here to Geneva.
I see. Okay, so now it's just a fascinating organization. So let me ask you the obvious question, first of all. And I mean, with all that information you've got, it's not going to be easy for you to distill it into a few paragraphs. But what does the science tell us about the state of the planet from the point of view of changes in the climate today? And is it a debate that's going on that we're maybe not aware of as non-specialists, or is there a general consensus?
There's a high-level consensus that we have already seen 1.2 degrees global warming, and we have also seen changes in the precipitation patterns. In some parts of the world, we have started observing more often drought, and some parts of the world, we have started observing more often flooding. All of the mountain glaciers are melting at the moment, and that's contributing to the sea level rise, especially this melting of Greenland and Antarctic glaciers, and all these mountain glaciers, once they are melting, we are getting less fresh water to the main rivers here in Europe, in Asia, in South America, and North America.
And in the Southern Hemisphere as well as the Northern Hemisphere.
Also, it's happening in both, both hemispheres, and we have seen warming of the oceans. The seawater at all depths have been warming, and we have stored actually 90% of excess heat to ocean, and that's giving more energy for the tropical storms. We have started seeing, for example, in southeastern Africa more often cyclones, which is a new phenomenon, and also we have started seeing more often these most intense tropical storms. And once you talk about Jamaica, for example, this 2017 hurricane season was the most damaging hurricane season so far.
Yes,
and we have also changed the composition of the atmosphere. We are year by year breaking the records of carbon dioxide concentrations. We have increased the carbon dioxide concentration about 140% since the pre-industrial times, and we have enhanced the methane concentration, second most important greenhouse gas concentration, by 250% since the 18th century.
Can I ask you to go back and just explain again that 90% regarding the oceans? I didn't quite understand that that number.
So we have started warming the planet, especially because of a higher concentration of carbon dioxide.
Right.
We are trapping the heat more to the lower atmosphere. And only a small fraction of that heat is visible in the atmosphere. Most of that heat is stored in the seawater.
In the seawater.
Yes.
I see. Okay. But let me. I tried my best to do some preliminary reading, as I'm no specialist, and sort of I turned to my old friend Encyclopedia Britannica, and there's a lot on climate change and a lot on the various cycles, and I was interested in the paragraph headings. And I'll just mention to you, seasonal, interannual, decadal, centennial, the last 10,000 years, millennial, and multi-millennial. These are the climate change. So can you just put into simple language, what that means in terms of someone like you who has to look at the big picture, but then begin to identify what is important and what is urgent when cycles can be going on for such a long period of time, please?
Yeah, we have seen this kind of long-term natural variability of climate, which is caused by the geometry between sun and earth. We have seen seen changes in the in the rotational parameters of Earth and also of the tilting of Earth, and this has caused, for example, this age variation. So we have seen glaciation and deglaciation periods, which is a natural phenomenon. But what has been happening during the past million years is unique. We have never seen during the past million years such an increase of carbon dioxide and methane concentrations, and it's clear that the science is clearly telling that the consumption of fossil fuels has caused this change.
Is it mathematical modeling that allows you to go back a million years to see what might have happened then? Is that how it works?
So we have so-called paleoclimatological means to study. We can study the sediments of the ocean bedrock, and then we can drill the ice cores of Greenland and Antarctica, and we can go back with these drilling techniques 800,000 years, and we can measure the old bubbles stored in the ice.
Really?
What is the greenhouse gas concentration? What is the methane concentration? And get the hint how this natural variability has been and what has been happening during the past, especially 100 years when we have started using these fossils.
By studying bubbles.
Exactly. So we can go back 800,000 years by drilling the ice cores of Antarctica and Greenland.
My goodness me, that's fascinating. Absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
So, Homo sapiens, mankind, is taking a lot of blame for the change in the climate. Can man unmake climate change? Can we do a lot individually, collect as countries, as governments, as communities?
Yeah, so we cannot fully stop this change, so we cannot go back to these pre-industrial times anymore very easily, because the lifetime of carbon dioxide is very long. It takes thousands of years to sediment the carbon dioxide back to the ocean bedrock where it's originally coming from, but we could seize this negative trend in 2060s by reducing the consumption of fossil fuels and by stopping deforestation, especially in the tropical rainforests. And the good news is that we have better and better technological means to be successful in this enterprise. The prices of solar and wind energy, they have been dropping under the prices of fossil energy. Most car manufacturers are providing electric vehicles. We could slightly decrease our consumption of red meat, which is partly provided by cutting the rainforests and planting soybeans, which are using as a feed for the cattle. So this diet can have an impact. And the good news is that these means in energy sector, transport sector, or diet sector, or consumption sector, they don't mean major changes in our everyday life. So with quite small changes in our daily life, we could see a ceasing of this negative trend in climate during the latter part of this century.
So from a political point of view, particularly in democracies, It would be easier for governments to change the behavior of people because the changes required would be quite small. And when you make a remark about the cost of wind power, etc., dropping, is that a real drop in cost, or are they being subsidized by governments through taxes, and so there's a concomitant increase in taxation at the other side, so that the consumer is paying the same anyway, but just paying in a different way?
Actually, when it started, it was subsidized. For example, in Germany, when they made the so-called Energiewende, they were subsidizing both solar and wind energy. But nowadays, there's no more need for subsidies because it's attractive for the investors anyhow. And that's why already 32 countries have reduced their emissions quite a bit during the past 15 years. and it's very much this energy transition that has been taking place.
These 32 countries, are they relatively big emitters anyway?
Those are mostly European countries. It's United States, It's Japan, Singapore, but also in for example, in Africa, they have started building more and more climate-friendly energy. It's especially solar and wind energy, and there's a boom going on everywhere in the world to build more such energy sources. And then they are developing also new type of nuclear reactors, which are also needed in countries like China, India, or Germany, where the energy demand is very, very high. We cannot comfort such amount of energy demand without nuclear energy, and also there's a chance to use a bit more bioenergy, and also in transport sector, this conversion to more electric transportation and electric bikes and so forth. Those are good means to reduce the emissions. So we have a growing amount of very attractive technological means to be successful in this effort.
So apart from behavioral change, there's also technological change.
There's good technology and affordable technology available. So there are good means to be successful in climate mitigation. At the moment, we are not heading towards the slow limit of Paris Agreement 1.5. We are heading towards 2.5 to 3 degrees. But to me, it's quite realistic to expect to see us hitting this upper limit of Paris Agreement 2 degrees.
That's a good news story.
During the latter part of this century.
Yeah. I've got to ask you a very specific question. It's something which I just read recently. I read an article that was entitled, a long title, "Scientists Struggle to Understand Why Antarctica Hasn't Warmed Over 70 Years Despite the Rise in CO2. It raised some interesting questions and accuses much of the climate science community of confirmation bias. I guess that must apply to universities and research institutes, asserting that few research grants are available to those who don't start with the premise that the climate is changing mostly or entirely due to humans burning fossil fuels. So, Professor Tullis, what evidence is there of the climate healing itself? And for example, are there places on the planet today where the glaciers are not receding? And what's your experience of what's happening in Antarctica?
Yeah.
Please.
So we have seen the most dramatic and largest change taking place in the Arctic, where we have...
In the Arctic.
The Arctic, where we have melted snow and ice, and there we have floating sea ice. And over to Antarctica, we have 2 to 3 kilometer thick glacier, and it's much slower process to melt that. But that has
so
also...
It's 2,000 to 3,000 meters thick in the Antarctic.
Exactly. Okay. And but also, for example, during recent sea level rise report that we published, or status of climate report that we published just a couple of months ago, it was shown that Greenland glacier melting has caused about 0.8 millimeters per year sea level rise. And the Antarctic glacier melting has caused 0.4 millimeters per year.
Quite a difference.
Sea level rise. And this melting of the Antarctic glacier has started later than the one in Greenland. But there we have the biggest potential for sea level rise. Some recent studies by NASA have shown that there's even a risk of 10 meter scale sea level rise by 2300, especially if there's an intrusion of seawater under the ice, which is speeding up the melting of the glacier.
10 meters is a lot. It sounds like a big number.
That's of course, if you look at many countries or big cities globally, like for example London or Rome or most big cities, they are on coasts. Globally, and that would be a major threat for those cities and various infrastructures at the coastal.
And how far into the future are you looking in that model?
So that's the estimate. This was a little bit, I would say, risk estimate there's a risk of up to 10 meters of sea level rise by 2300.
2300.
But the conservative estimate at the moment, according to the most recent IPCC report, is showing that we could see something like 0.5 meter to 1 meter per per century sea level rise. So this is a fairly slow process, and
manageable.
It's manageable, and we have some evidence that 3 million years ago we were having similar concentration of of carbon dioxide that we are having today, and then the temperatures were about 2 to 4 degrees higher than today, and the sea level was 10 to 20 meters higher than today. So these big glaciers of Greenland and Antarctica, they are the drivers of this.
So there's lots of imponderables you have to balance in trying to come to a judgment.
Exactly. Yeah. So this is one of the things to be followed, and that's also one of the big risk these issues for the coming centuries.
Okay, well, we won't be here to worry
we
about
won't
it.
Be here, so that's not our problem, but it's a problem for the future, of course.
My guest today is Professor Petteri Tallas, and he's the Secretary General of the World Meteorological Organization, and we're in his office here in the heart of Geneva. Professor, why, and this is perhaps a very unfair question to ask you as a physicist, because this is in the realms of existentialism, why has climate change taken on the mantle of a religion in the minds and actions of some people? Does it blur rational thinking that people get so emotional about it?
So it's we can have two types of emotions here. Unfortunately, plenty of young people are now afraid of the future. So they and some journalists especially are telling that there's a risk that the mankind would die out, and the whole biosphere would die out.
That's right.
And that's not based on our models.
Well, what would you say to young people?
I would say that we are going to face various scales of gray. So the future will be a bit gray anyhow, because this negative trend will continue for the coming decades anyhow, meaning growing amount of negative impacts of climate change, but we could seize this negative trend. And if we fail with this, then we would see darker gray future, and the living conditions at some parts of the world would be very challenging. But even in that case, we wouldn't see the disappearance of mankind. So that's, those are not true stories.
Yeah.
It's good to put some pressure on policymakers and big business companies, but to put this pressure on the young people, that's unfair.
And
our models are not showing that there's such a risk that we would see a total disaster on this planet.
Okay,
But on the other hand, one should listen to this science message carefully and act accordingly. And,
yes.
and this act is now needed, and we have started acting, but we should raise the ambition level of this.
So it requires full knowledge, as near as possible for non-specialists, and judgment, being able to discriminate between what is sensible and what may be just what they nowadays call fake news.
Exactly. We have started seeing too much of a fake news concerning this apocalyptic future. But on the other hand, especially in the past, there were those climate skeptics which were totally falsifying the facts, and this is, of course, not fair either. But I think that since we have started seeing the impacts of climate change, and it's visible everywhere on this planet, these skeptics are more or less disappearing.
Well, I'm going to mention the name of one skeptic, although he's a friend of mine. I had him here in Geneva about 10 years ago. I think he even came to this building. I interviewed Professor Ted Singer. But another one, a scientist who's not a skeptic, Professor Tim Palmer, Oxford University, I think you know them both, although Fred died some years ago, sadly. I'm sure you know them both. They talked to me about the importance of clouds, and I must confess I was a bit puzzled by that. They hold a special significance, apparently, in the climate science debate. What is the significance of clouds in the science debate, Professor?
So clouds are also, of course, important component of this radiation balance of the planet, and if we would have more cloudiness, we could shield the lower atmosphere,
if we
would have more clouds, and it's very important that these clouds are parametrized in a correct way in the climate models, and it's of course a matter also for the weather forecasting, and since we have been able to get the higher supercomputing resources available for this, both for weather forecasting and climate climate scenario calculation, we have been able to go to the cloud physics in a much better way. And we still, once we get more supercomputing resources available, we could improve those models.
But is there evidence that the clouds are less than they were years ago, or they're just in a different place from where they were years ago? Is it a combination of both?
It's a combination of both, and they are, of course, an important component in both weather forecasting models and in the climate models. So we can describe them in the models, but we could still improve the how we treat them once we get more, once we get bigger supercomputing resources.
So that's
available.
A data gathering exercise.
I see.
Question which I've asked other of my guests about different topics, but I ask you this about climate change. What don't we know about climate change? In other words, what are the known unknowns? When you sit at your desk and you're scratching your head thinking, God, if only I knew that, but I don't know that, but you're aware that something's out there. What are those things that make you scratch your head and think hard?
I would say two things. For example, the speed of the melting of Antarctic glacier, that's one of the things where we have big uncertainty, and it has been demonstrated that there are also big risks if we would see this 10 meters sea level rise by 2300. So of course that would be really a game changer. And the other one is what's going to happen to the weather extremes in the future.
Yes.
With the current climate models, we can describe these average changes fairly properly. So what's going to happen to temperature, what's going to happen to the tropical storms, and what's going to happen to the precipitation patterns globally.
And what's the time horizon? Is it five years, or three years?
We are talking about this climate model runs for the coming 50 years or 100 years.
As long as that?
So those are available, but we don't have enough information on the weather extremes. Actually, the biggest impacts of climate change, they are felt through these weather extremes. And again, there's a need to have these biggest possible supercomputing resources to go to higher resolution of those models, and then we could describe also these weather extremes in a better fashion.
That's also
one of the things where there's a need for further evolution.
Okay, this is my last question, Professor, and I don't know about you. I get the impression that you're a bit like me. I'm a glass half full man, not a glass half empty man. How did the human species adapt to change of climates in past times? I mean, can't humankind adapt again, as we always have done as a species? Or is there just too many of us these days compared with, even 100 years ago, let alone 200 or 300 years ago? Adaptation, tell me a little bit about that.
So anyhow, we have to adapt to climate change, since this negative trend will continue for the coming decades, meaning bigger impacts of climate change, and we have to mitigate these negative impacts of climate change, and one mean is to improve the weather forecasts, and that's a challenge in half of our member countries in Africa, Caribbean, Pacific Islands, especially where we don't have state-of-the-art early warning
services. That's a resource question, is it?
That's a resource question, and it's also, and that's why we have now a major program called Early Warning Services for All. Secretary General Guterres has given us a mandate to prepare such an action plan that in 5 years we would have 100% coverage of proper early warning services. And of course we have also plenty of technological means, and we have to take it into account in agriculture, business, and various infrastructures, how to cope with rising sea level, higher temperatures, changes in precipitation patterns.
And does that depend on governments, or is there private enterprise, private sector also working with government?
So both are needed. So governments can allocate some resources, and they can direct these activities, but most of the financing has to come from private sector, and also from us as consumers.
I see. Okay. Look, we're out of time, Professor. It's fascinating. I mean, we could have this debate, and I hope we will have this debate again, because it's evolving, as you said. And I just thank you again for inviting me here. You're very helpful, and I found illuminating answers. My guest today has been Professor Petteri Tallas, Secretary General of the World Meteorological Organization. Thank you, Professor.
It was my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
That was the McKay Interview with Michael McKay. And don't forget, you can hear that interview again on our website, worldradio.ch.